I'm George Samueli, and as gagglers can see, as everybody can see, we are together. We're here for our Monday morning East Coast time of the live stream. So
there's an Easter motif here, the return. Okay.
Yes. Yes. we're returning. And it seems, I mean, you know, knock on wood, that we have solved our technical issues, or at least Peter, you've solved your technical issues. So that's all very good. And so everybody, you know, focus. There'll be a test, a very, very hard test at the end, so
The Strait of Hormuz may be closed, but the gaggle is open. Okay,
exactly. You know, whatever happens in the world, the gaggle is always open for business. So the big news, obviously, that since we last spoke was the Hungarian election, which I have to say caught me a little bit by surprise, because I was maybe hoping or whatever, but I was hoping for an Orban victory. And while I didn't think that he would win decisively, nothing like the landslide victories that he had accomplished in previous elections, I did think that he could pull off a narrow victory.
From an outsider looking in, okay, was this election about him?
Well, I think partly, but I do think that it was about Hungarians feeling that they were being left out of the club. I think that this was the European club, that an Orban was somehow carving out this new position for Hungary that was outside of all of the traditional alliances and the, you know, all the traditional systems. And I think the Hungarians wanted to be back. I think they wanted to return. And
how much of this was a generational issue?
That was a generational issue. I mean, no question that there were the young people. But I think one has to say that the EU campaign had been very successful. They managed to focus all of their sanctions and bullying and everything very, very successfully against Orban, and he for some reason was caught a little flat-footed. His campaign didn't have his usual energy to it. It seemed a little tired.
He's not a young man.
He'd run out of ideas.
He's not a young man.
He made it very obsessively about Zelensky, and I didn't really see the point of that. I mean, but he made it just totally preoccupied. I mean, I can see why he would run against von der Leyen. I mean, he's done that before, running against von der Leyen and Merz and all the rest of them. Putting Zelensky front and center was a little odd, but what the EU did was obviously they withheld funds that had an impact on Hungary. That was 17 billion euros worth. That's a lot of money for a
small country
as Hungary, and of course, and then they applied all kinds of other pressure. For instance, keeping out Hungarians from the Erasmus program, so that obviously alienated young people. You know, young people want to be part. You know, go travel to all these other universities in Europe. And then they hit Hungary with all those fines. Hungary was getting fined €1 million a day for its policies on the border. And then they had all the other pressures on the LGBTQ stuff, and all the pressure on judicial reform, and then what they call corruption. But they, I mean, they always called it corruption, but essentially what Orban was doing was Hungarianizing the economy. He was trying to make sure that it's Hungarians who get the contracts. Hungarians get preferential treatment as opposed to Europeans, particularly giant European corporations. That obviously didn't go down at all well.
Make Hungary great again?
It what?
Make Hungary great again?
Well, that's right. And that was certainly his policy. And of course, you know, the EU responded with fury, and they called it all corruption, cronyism, and so on.
That never happens in Brussels.
No, never, absolutely never happens. And so they both, you know, applied a great deal of pressure, and they kind of came up with this fake, phony kind of character, the leader of the opposition, somebody called Peter Magyar.
Okay, well, George, he was a political ally of Orbán.
He had been. Yes, exactly. He had been, but he had not been a very prominent figure within Fidesz. I mean, he was Fidesz and so, but he wasn't a prominent figure.
He was married to a
exactly. That was, people just knew him with the fact that he was married to Orbán's former justice minister Judit Varga, and then of course he recorded a personal conversation between him and his wife in which she supposedly confessed to some kind of corruption. It was hard to tell from that tape. But either way, he snitched out his wife. He handed the recording of his conversation with his wife to the police. Apparently, Hungarians didn't seem to have any problems with that. I mean,
well, George, having problems with this guy, now, obviously, is Orban's legion of enemies, almost none of which are Hungarian, on Twitter X, which it was just an avalanche, still is, okay. Now, if I am to believe the people criticizing Peter Magyar, if I'm to believe 10% of what I've read in the last 5-6 hours, this guy is unfit for office. You and I are just kind of, you know, we really are conservative. I don't want to go into the nitty gritty and the ugliness of what some people are alleging.
Right.
But some people say it's far more than allegations.
It's far, far more so. And she, you know, his wife has said,
write a book about it.
Yeah, she'd written a book about it. Alleges physical cruelty that he had engaged in against her.
Dog cruelty.
That's exactly that. And one should say, she claims that he put a dog into the microwave, and not nice. And again, you would have thought people who like dogs would be kind of shocked and upset by anything along those lines. He also behaved, well, she claims, in a very kind of lewd and lascivious way in front of their children, And of course, there are allegations about, you know, the shady business dealings. But it all goes, it goes to the fact that really very little is known about him. I mean, he's really come out of nowhere. You know, somewhat like Obama in around 2006, 2007. Really, basically, well, what do you know about this guy? I mean, he hasn't held any kind of public office. He hasn't, you know, he hasn't run in too many elections. So, and you're about
that's why he was elected.
Exactly. You're going to entrust the destiny of the country into somebody like that.
Okay. But George, the way it's framed in the mainstream is I think they, you know, I started this habit. Maybe I shouldn't do it. But, you know, when I see something stupid on Twitter, I say, post, think before you post. Okay. Ukraine should have never given up on its nukes. Okay, yeah. You know, that kind of nonsense, right? Okay, so Peter Magyar was a political ally, even if it, you know, displaced one, you know, right. Because he was a spouse of one of his cabinet members. So the immigration policy is going to end. The family policy is going to end. They're going to start sending money to Ukraine. All of these things. I don't think so. You know, this Peter Madjar guy, if, you know, if it's real or not, he said, we're going to have to sit down and talk to the Russians. I thought that's what Audubon said.
But this, that's why. But I absolutely do not believe any of these stories. This is where you get into the whole the manufactured candidacy. So everybody rallied around Madjar, or you know, the left or center, or, you know, everybody who's against Orbán rallied behind Madjar, and they knew that there was no way they can defeat Orbán by running a kind of leftish, center-leftish candidate. So essentially, they knew that they had to have somebody who sounded conservative, who sounded nationalist. But, you know, it's one thing to run as a conservative and as a nationalist. It's quite another thing to govern it. And well, what he has done, what you know, Madjar has done is saying the whole thrust of his camp, his program is he's going to get the 17 billion euros from Europe. That's not, he doesn't have any plan beyond that. He's going to get that 17 billion out of the hands of the Europeans. They're not going to give it to him if he's going to pursue Orbán's policies. I mean, that's just common sense. They're not, I mean, that, you know, there's going to be strings attached.
Well, I mean, but what I understand, okay, again, my first question, I think, is a germane one. Was this just a campaign against Audubon? Because, you know, when you do just a cursory review, this was some kind of, if not temporary, alliance of very strange political bedfellows. Okay. Okay. So, yeah, you derailed Audubon after 16 years in power, elected with nice margins four times. Okay. All right. Mission accomplished. So you want the money and then the political games start all over again. I mean, I don't understand this, because if you know you're making a temporary alliance to get rid of a person, usually you have a temporary alliance to move forward a policy.
But it wasn't. He really never had any policy. I mean, essentially it was just his platform was anti-Orbán, like Orbán, corruption, cronyism. Oh, and the Hungarian economy is doing dreadfully. So that's it. You just keep repeating. He never gave any interviews. So all the idea, oh, he has this position, or he's that position, or he thinks this, he thinks that. None of it is based on anything. He basically avoided any real interviews. He was a sort of a, kind of the Kamala Harris type, you know, just avoid talking to the press.
No, Joe Rogan.
That's right. And then so whenever the issue of you know, well, are you gonna? What are you gonna do about migrants? He said, "Well, we really don't want to have too many migrants here." You know, that's right. Well, what about Ukraine? Well, we gotta be very careful. You know, we don't want to start, you know, just sending weapons to Ukraine. So he very deftly dodged any awkward questions. And, you know, Obama's done this. You know, it's like, you know, if you have clever handlers, they basically tell you don't. You know, make yourself a hostage to fortune by making any promises. But it was clear from his speeches that the heart of his program is to get in with Brussels. That's what it's about. That's what it's all about. And so get in with Brussels, we are going to be at the heart of the EU. We are going to be at the heart of NATO.
Yeah, but I mean, to get this money, he's going to have to perform some tricks like a dog, yeah?
Yeah, for Brussels, yeah. But the point is this, he's now won an election. He doesn't have to worry about, you know, what the Hungarian people want or not. Hey, elections have consequences. I mean, Obama said this, and it's true. The Hungarian people have voted. They voted out Orbán. They voted him out decisively. Now he's got a mandate. He can do pretty much what he wants. And if Hungarians don't like it, well, you know, it's too late now. You
made like any other European country.
Right, exactly. And, you know, and given the scale of his victory, you know, it's going to be 4 years, maybe 8 years, maybe 12 years before Fidesz will be back in. I mean, it's, you know, this is not a one election that you can just recover from. I mean, if you just look at here, we can look at the division. In the parliament, I mean, he's got the two-thirds majority, which is what Orbán had. You can see here he's got 138 out of 199 seats. Fidesz only has 55. So, you know, it's, you know, it's two and a half times as many seats as Fidesz has. So that's going to take, you know, you don't recover from a defeat of this magnitude in just one election cycle. So, you know, Hungarians are going to be unhappy with any Tiso's policies. Well, you're going to have to just put up with it. And then if you look at the people who responded, I think it's very important that, you know, the last night, who were the enthusiasts for this this victory. Here's Alex Soros. You know, we know, of course, George Soros had a long, bitter, acrimonious fight with Orban. And here's Alex Soros says, Russians go home.
But there are no Russians in
here. Well, that's very interesting. But that, but it's, you know, that's what we had, particularly last night during the sort of celebrations, they kept chanting, Ruskik Hoza. Now, this phrase, Ruskik Hoza, this goes back to 1956. Essentially, it means, in Hungarian, Russians go home. But that referred to the Soviet armed forces who were in Hungary in 1956. So it made some sense to say Ruskis Khaza in 1956. But there haven't been any Russian forces in Hungary since, you know, 1990 or 1991. That's 35 years. So what Russians are we talking about? And yet people were chanting this. People were chanting during the rally for Magyar, Ruskik Khaza. People were walking around in the streets, you know, chanting Ruski Khaza. People were in the subways chanting Ruski Khaza.
Manufactured consent.
Manufactured consent. It's that's exactly it. You've now told people, oh, there are Russians everywhere. If you were to explain to them where are these Russians, well, they don't know. I say, well, you're buying cheap Russian oil and gas. You know, how does that make Russians? Oh, so you don't want to buy cheap Russian oil and gas? Okay, great. So where are you going to get your Russian oil? Where are you going to get your oil and gas?
You said it's going to be very difficult to recover from this electoral defeat. But I said to you yesterday, because we obviously anticipated talking about it today, is that given the lack of an agenda other than I don't like Orbán and, you know Russians go home, all right, this guy, Peter Macha, is going to be unpopular in 3 months.
He is, I think he will be.
You're right. It doesn't matter. He has a mandate now. Okay, but that's what I said. Is that Hungary? They say this with inverted quotes. Obviously, Hungary will now become a normal European country. Right. The people will have resentment against Brussels. None of these elites have any clue on how to run the economy, and of course, they all hate Russia. So, yep. Welcome aboard, Hungary, to political and intellectual and moral stagnation.
Well, that's absolutely right. And that brings up the real question of Orban. I mean, what he has achieved, this was quite extraordinary during the 16 years. I mean, Hungary is a small country. He had pretty much carved out for himself a kind of the role of a de Gaulle. I mean, you know, he's obviously, Hungary is not as big as France. Hungary is not as important as France. But he did become a kind of a de Gaulle-like figure, you know, independent foreign policy, not really aligned with any bloc, and a major figure, a major European figure, you know, somebody people wanted to meet, somebody people wanted to talk to, wanted to get his endorsement. He was something, you know, he's an interlocutor. He could be a mediator. I mean, he was... Hungary was really punching above.
Remember, he went from Budapest to Moscow to Beijing to Mar-a-Lago. I mean, that's a political rock star.
Exactly. That's right. And so that's what made him. And he almost alone in Europe, he opposed the EU's migration policy almost from the beginning. He stood against that. He opposed the EU particularly, and this is going to be a very big issue, the EU's war policy against Russia. He was constantly the thorn in the EU side, making difficulties on that. And then, of course, he was against all the fashionable nostrums on families and everything else. And he kind of almost alone. I mean, people tried to emulate him, but he was alone. With him gone, Hungary just quickly reverts back to irrelevance. It just simply is a country no one's going to pay any more attention to.
You know, one of the, you know, the days and hours before the polls finally closed, I'm sure you noticed it as well. They have to get rid of the autocrat, Orban. But, you know, everybody, you know, let's unpack that. I mean, if he was an autocrat, he'd still be in power. Okay? I mean, but what autocrats go by the electoral decision of the right. citizenry, okay? So, right. And actually, I was really surprised and almost you could feel people, you know, even the usual suspects, I don't go through them here, but, you know, blah, 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 blah. Well, and at the very end, well, at least he went gracefully.
That's right. Yeah, that's right.
You noticed that? You know that? I saw that a number of times today.
That's right. Exactly. That's right. But somehow, oh, he was going to steal the election. He was going to refuse to recognize the election result. Instead, he came out with only about 40% of the votes counted and conceded. So he conceded very early on. He didn't have to, but he conceded very early on.
But Peter Magyar, when he forms his government, there's going to be a very in-depth investigation into Russian meddling in the election, right, George?
Well, this is, and that, of course.
Oh, but of course, they won't be talking about the meddling of the EU. Okay. Another question here. Was it a mistake for Trump and Vance to be so supportive of Orban?
No, I don't think so. I think that I think on the contrary, Trump made it. It was too late by the time Trump really, you know, it was about 24 hours before the polls opened. He essentially gave a kind of an open credit line to Hungary. He should have done it last November. I think Orban wanted it last November.
He talked about this.
Do for him what you did to Milei, essentially open credit line. And don't threaten him with sanctions. He threatened Hungary with sanctions. And then he said, oh, well, I'll give you one year waiver on the sanctions. And Orban said, oh, we've got a limitless waiver. And then Trump said, no, it's not limitless. It's just for 1 year. So all of that just made...
What was the cost to keep? What was the cost to Trump to do that?
None at all. I think it just left it too late. By last week, I think it was already. It didn't make any difference.
I guess you have to say that Trump's got a lot on his plate right now.
I suppose, but he should, you know, given his fondness for Orban, it was,
CPAC. Highlight a headliner at CPAC.
Yeah, exactly. So he should have done that, but the. When you said Russian interference, of course, as usual, no Russian interference, but a hell of a lot of Western interference. We had, you know, day after day of the release of these phone conversations.
Oh, I didn't need to.
Some years back.
I read one transcript, and I'm not bothering with this anymore. I mean, as you and I talked about, these so-called leaks and all that, I mean, most of the information the leaks provided are on the Kremlin website.
Well, that's right. I mean, so... Exactly. They were just more detailed. I mean, these were transcripts. But there's nothing in them that somehow belies the record as we knew them. We knew that Orban was very excited about the prospect of a summit in Budapest between Trump and Putin.
Yeah.
And Orban would be
a big deal.
He would be the mediator and he would be the peacemaker and would probably seal his re-election. And he called after the announcement the day before by Trump that there would be the summit in Budapest. You know, Orban telephoned Putin in Moscow, and of course, they had a very friendly, very cordial conversation. That's what you would expect. And there's nothing in that Kremlin. The conversation is described on the Kremlin website, and there's nothing to suggest that it wasn't cordial. I mean, they didn't go into details, but it was obviously a cordial conversation because they're on the same page. They want the summit to happen. But you're right. And then they had conversation with Siarto and Lavrov, also very cordial. You know, they're on first name terms, and so there was absolutely nothing there because, you know, it's only a news story if the private record belies the public record. But if the two are exactly the same, then what's the story? Where's the scandal? but who was releasing this? Who has the means to have the transcripts of phone conversations between foreign ministers? Who has the means to do this? Well, obviously the Western Intelligence Service, and you know, it's a question of how many of them. A number of them obviously were involved in this operation to try to suggest that, oh, the Hungarian government is in cahoots with Putin.
You know, it was interesting, again, just kind of the cursory, you know, going through the, you know, the messages and all that, you know, almost to the person, the critics that were critics of Orbán, they refused ever to use this following word, sovereignty. They never mentioned it. They never mentioned that, you know, they did everything. They, you know, they pull out the lexicon, everything was there, but they never talked about him as a sovereigntist. And that's exactly because people have asked me, you know, well, Peter, what's going on with this Orbán guy? And I said, look, he's sticking up for Hungarians. Okay. Is he, you know, would he fit in well with the New York liberals? No, he wouldn't. Okay. He's a very conservative guy. And I'd say, and I think you can attest to it. He was detested in Budapest, but in the rest of the country, you know, four elections, so he did very, very well. Did he win? I don't know. Did he ever win Budapest? I doubt it.
I doubt it.
And so, I mean, you want to demonize him because he doesn't worship on the altar of neoliberalism in Brussels. And I said, you know, and if that's your gig, that's fine. But, you know, make Hungary great again. Okay. You know, is he Putin puppet? And I said, I don't think he even likes Russia. Okay. I mean, the thing is, he has the national interests of the country at hand here. And he sees how the EU's policy is a form of self-deletion for the EU. He doesn't want to be part of that. Okay. Right. So he said, you know, you can take your pick. Okay.
Yes. No,
first and foremost, he's a sovereigntist.
Exactly. And on one policy after another, he's essentially, well, what is good for Hungary? He said, you know, migration is a terrible thing for Hungary, which is, it's a small country with a declining population. And it's, you know, in no time at all, the Hungary would be a completely transformed country, as are other countries in Europe that have basically allowed themselves to be overrun by migrants. So not more migration. Energy says, hey, it's in our interest to get cheap energy from Russia, oil and gas from Russia. So, you know, there's that. And of course, what most important is, it's in our interest and it's in Europe's interest to avoid a war in Ukraine. And that's what the one who was warning about most vehemently for years, that in Brussels, they're planning to go to war with Russia. He was the one major figure on the scene who was absolutely opposed to it. Now he's gone, and I think that's a significant blow. It's a significant hindrance from Brussels' point of view. He is gone, and that's when you look at these.
The echo chamber is pure now.
Exactly, yes. Exactly. And if we look at these tweets that went out yesterday and today, so there's again Soros. Soros was really going on town. So here's. The people of Hungary have taken back their country, a resounding rejection of entrenched corruption and foreign interference. Can you imagine a Soros complaining about foreign interference?
That's their family business.
That's right. And then here's Tusk. Hungary, Poland, Europe, back together. Glorious victory, dear friends. And there he is again. He repeats, Ruski Khazar. Hillary Clinton, she chimes in. The end of Viktor Orban's autocratic regime. So it's autocratic, but somehow he had an election and he lost an election. I don't know how an autocratic regime does that. An autocratic regime is a victory, not just for Hungary, but for people who value democracy around the world. Congratulations to Tisza, the incoming leader, Peter Magyar, and to Hungarians everywhere. And then we have Macron, I just spoke with Peter Magyar to congratulate him on his victory in Hungary. France welcomes the victory of democratic participation. The Hungarian people's commitment to the values of the European Union, Hungary's commitment to Europe.
Yeah, but Orbán was, Orbán was elected because of democratic participation.
That's right. There was democratic participation. That's it. That's exactly it. That was that's how he won these elections. But somehow the point about these Europeans is it's only a democratic election
when they get their
the right result. So yes, this was a victory for democracy because we got the right result. If it had gone the other way, if Orbán had been reelected, then autocracy has prevailed. This election was a fraud. This election was rigged, and they would have imposed sanctions on Hungary. Hungary would have been excluded.
Well, they could have done a Romania.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, all of that was on the cards. They were never going to recognize an Orbán victory.
George, what happens to Viktor now?
Well, I think that they're going to prosecute him. I think that there's going to be pressure coming on Magyar from the EU that you prosecute him. You prosecute him for corruption and I think this is significant, try and prosecute him for treason. And I think they're going to go for that as well. Treason for collaborating with Russia.
Hey, pull the gallows out of the garage.
I think they're going to go for broke. I think they're going to go for treason and say that he was not just breaking ranks with the EU when he was making these visits to Moscow, when we had decreed that no one is to have any contacts with Putin, but he was essentially colluding and collaborating with the enemy. He was ignoring sanctions. The sanctions regime in Hungary was kind of very lax, to say the least.
With all this breakneck news going on, is the EU officially at war with Russia? How can you commit treason then?
I think so. I think they're gonna go for both of them, and that's why it's very important to keep in mind that Orbán, he had been a very fairly reliable anti-communist. When he first emerged on the scene in the late 1980s, and he first shot to prominence when he spoke at the reburial of Imre Nagy in 1989. He was a young man then. So everyone thought, oh, fantastic, he's going to be part of the new leadership of Hungary, reliably anti-communist, reliably pro-Western. And Soros gave him money. He got money. He went to Oxford, on a Soros award. But they got this wrong. After a while, Orbán went his own way. He was his own man. That's something that they're not going to see that same mistake again.
But that trajectory has never been given any kind of legitimacy, because that's my trajectory. I was anti-communist. I mean, I probably knew more about communism than most people hating communism, okay? But I have conservative values, okay? And that means I do not like liberalism. And so there is a trajectory they never give recognition of, because you can be anti-communist and not a liberal. See, they scramble these things up. There are different trajectories of thought here.
No, I agree. And I think what he also realized was that he wanted to maintain Hungary's independence. The Hungarians have traditionally been very proud of their nation state. It's an ancient nation state. It was around as a state long before most of the states that are around today. The Kingdom of Hungary had been around hundreds of years ago. So Hungarians are really proud of that.
And hundreds of years ago, they could kick your ass. Okay,
absolutely.
Mess with the Magyar.
You never mess with them. So they have a sudden independence. They said, well, we don't want to be run by others. Hungary should be able to carve out its own policy. So it's like when you said he's not pro-Russia. Of course he's not. He's not pro-Russia. It's a complete nonsense that they're presenting he's pro-Russian or whatever. He is pro-Hungarian. What's
go, good? For- go back to the interview that he did with Tucker. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he mentioned something that I'm sure you probably don't, you're oblivious to it now because you live there. But I remember when I spent my half year, 9 months there, you could still see the remnants of the 1956, fighting, the bullet holes in the buildings and stuff like that. And Urban quoted that. Yeah, we're very aware of that. Okay. But that was then.
Yeah. Right.
You know, I mean, do you want to relitigate the past? You want to keep your apartments warm in the winter?
Well, that's the point. And this is something, it's only non-Hungarians who are always bringing up 1956. The Poles keep bringing up 1956. And, you're friendly with the Russians. You know, look what they did to you in 1956. Yeah, that was 70 years ago. You know, are we going to relitigate everything? Well, I guess the Poles say, yeah, we're going to keep relitigating everything.
The Poles, that's part of their DNA.
Right, okay. Yeah, relitigate. Yeah, okay, fine.
That's what they do.
Okay. Right, so, but an intelligent policy, well, okay, that was then, that was the past. We kind of have to appreciate it, respect it, but it's still the past. I mean, it's gone. It's dead.
Now, George,
we have to move on.
This whole the U.S. relationship with Britain, you know, they burned down the White House in 1812. I think we need to go back and reassess this. Okay,
absolutely. You could relitigate anything at all that you want, and you know, it's a lucrative enterprise to best relitigate, and suddenly you get second, third, fourth, fifth hand resentment about things that happened to, you know, ancestors of yours hundreds of years ago. I mean, it's phony. It's obviously phony. It didn't happen to you. So what are you getting so worked up about? For the Baltic states, you know, it's very useful for them to continue to relitigate what happened in 1940. Okay, that's 1940. That's 85 years ago. I mean, you know, that's going to be your lodestar for what happens now.
Yep.
So
to finish up on that point, I mean, yeah, let's relitigate the past. While you're wasting your time doing that, you're not looking at the ideological pillars of the EU that is just destroying the living standards of the average person. Okay, well, let's talk about Katyn. Okay, let's go back to Katyn.
Yeah, let's talk about Katyn. Exactly. Yeah.
Meanwhile, how's your middle class going?
All right. Well, that's it. Yeah. No question. It's so much more fun to do that. So now, with Orban gone, I think clearly they're going to go to Magyar and make clear to him, you have to do this, 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 and this. If you want this money, we're not just going to sit there, you know, whip out the checkbook when von der Leyen comes around probably tomorrow. You got to do, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And then maybe we'll give you a little bit to keep you going. Don't think you're going to get that 17 billion right away. So, keep you going for a little bit.
We're going to send a minder from Brussels. Nice office space, please. Okay.
Nice office space.
Put them up in the Hyatt, penthouse.
That's right. And they're going to say, you need to begin the prosecution, not just of Orban, but all of the people around Orban. Begin the process of prosecution. You know, what you call corruption. Keep move that. And then, as I say, treason. You know, begin treason trials. These people, they are playing for keeps. They're not just going to sit back and allow Orban to come back in 4 years' time. That's not the plan. No,
yeah,
Orbanism crushed once and for all.
These people are, and people have blocked me for giving them the following designation. They're ideologically possessed.
Yeah.
This is a form of possession.
Right. Right. Yeah, no, that's right. It is. This is their agenda. This is this liberal European agenda, and anybody who challenges it will get punished. and punished very harshly. So these people that they obviously don't care about democracy. We've seen how, what contempt that they have for democracy, whether it's Romania or Moldova or Georgia or anything else. They don't care about democracy. You have to be get on the with the program.
Yeah, because these places are abstract. No. They're abstractions, okay? Right. And the way that you mediate or understand these abstractions is right. Your very narrow definition right. of democracy, which is, underpins their ideology, okay?
That's right.
I mean,
that's right.
Do you think, you know, Moldova? I mean, we did many podcasts about it.
Many of them, yeah.
I mean, I know Moldovans. I've been there, okay? But these people that chime on about it, it's just an abstraction.
Of course it is. Of course it is. As was Hungary. I mean, you know, we said at the beginning, I mean, how all these people on Twitter, I mean, you make bomb Hungary. None of them have the slightest idea about Hungary. They've never been to Hungary. They don't know the first thing about it. What they know about Hungary, what they've been told, is that there's this guy called Orban, and he's a really bad guy, and he's friends with Putin, and apparently he's friends with Trump.
Here's a guy, power for 16 years.
Yeah.
Go to Budapest. Anyone here watching? It is a delightful city. How can an autocrat, you know, run such a delightful city? Okay. It doesn't make any sense. You go there and it's so very different. And, you know, the whole Soros thing, I'm glad you brought it up. I mean, it's, you know, Soros, these people have a racket, and it's like when I was growing up, you know, McDonald's, they get that Happy Meal out there. Capture those young people. Happy Meal will have customers for life. And then they just divvy out money. But you know, you go to this place, you get a plane ticket and all. I know tons of people all through my life that went through that. Yeah, I know a couple of them said, I just took the money. This stuff was BS, but I just took the money anyway.
Yeah. Right. But and then you remember
the open society junk.
Yeah,
and all
of that. And this was the big deal for when Soros, I mean, Soros kind of launched. You know, that was the heart of the Soros Empire in Hungary. That's where he set up this that fake university, the Central European University, which was, you know, remember that melodrama that went on for several years about, oh, the Central European University, the finest educational institution in the Western world, and Orban is driving it out. It wasn't in any way a fine educational institution, but it was a fraud. It was a fake institution that was handing out degrees that were at accredited American university and at an accredited Hungarian university. So they got an unfair advantage over Hungarian universities. And that's what they brought to an end. It's still here. The Central European University is still here. But nobody goes there now because they're just handing out Hungarian degrees, and no one's interested in that. I mean, it's the American degrees that people wanted, but it didn't have an American campus, hence they couldn't hand out those American degrees anymore. But there was this hysteria about how Orban is persecuting a university. So this, I think now Hungary will move gradually towards irrelevance. I think they're going to have to get themselves off the energy. I think that's going to be, there's going to be a lot of pressure applied. You get your oil from, you know, via the Adriatic.
Persian Gulf.
Yeah. The oil. I don't know. This Croatian oil, where is Croatia getting its oil? So I guess it's the Persian Gulf. I don't know, but that's it. Oh no, you've got to get it from, yeah, from, it's through Croatia. No more of pipeline oil for you. So that's that gas. Well, forget about the gas. People are going to be more for their energy.
Because George, all these people, do you think von der Leyen, do you think she's want for anything? I mean, does she think, what's going to be the price of energy? She doesn't know the price of energy. No. She doesn't know the price of food. She doesn't know the price of transportation. No. She doesn't know the price of labor. Okay, none of these people do. They live in their castles or in their palaces, and the peasants are complaining again. Don't they know how much we do for them? Okay,
that's right.
It's exactly, this is a feudalism. They're returning to feudalism.
Right. That's right. And of course, it's very interesting because, I mean, von der Leyen, of course, was born in a very rich family. So the rich family. And then, of course, she married into money, as, of course, rich people often do. So she, you know, I mean, von der Leyen is a married name. That wasn't her her maiden name. She married into that. Then she got this fake, phony political career, but only because her father had been a big shot within the CDU. So suddenly she gets waltzes right into a kind of top position within the CDU, fails completely at everything, but waltzes in to become, Angela Merkel's go-to person. She becomes the president of the EU Commission. So money, ease at all times, arrogance, entitlement, all of that, and that she oozes that, and the EU oozes all of that, the smugness, the complacency, the entitlement, and a complete lack of interest in even what it should be its ostensible purpose, which is the benefit of the European people.
Before it was Ukraine, it was COVID, and see how they did that, how they rolled that, and how it's you're not allowed to even talk about EU COVID policy. It's just not there. There's plenty to know there.
And that again brings in von der Leyen. Why did she order, what is it, I think, 4.5 million doses?
Billion.
4.5 million, I think. You're right, 4.5 billion. You're right, billion, because it was, so in other words, it was 10, basically 10 doses of vaccine per person in the EU. 4.5 billion.
And the transcript and the record, it all disappeared. What happened? Oh, it just.
Yeah, what happened on all that? Yeah. That's right. And particularly as her husband's in the pharmaceutical industry.
You know, well, there you go. Good to have good friends in the industry. Yeah.
All right.
What a scam. Okay.
Yeah, complete scammer. So the other topic, of course, in the hour is the blockade that is supposedly, it should be starting about now.
Yeah. It's 48 minutes in.
Right. Yes, that's right. So
we're going to blockade the blockaders.
it all seems kind of, not nonsensical. It's hard to say exactly what Trump is hoping to accomplish by this. Particularly, I guess the idea behind it, Iran doesn't get any revenue, so denying Iran revenue.
That was a long-standing policy, okay? We're going to sanction Iran? What are you talking about?
Right.
Keep going, sorry.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think that Iran has shown itself to be quite adept at getting around U.S. sanctions and quite adept at finding ways around whatever limitations that the United States imposes. And the idea that this is going to bring Iran to its knees just seems strange. I mean, you've been bombing Iran. That hasn't brought it to its knees. So it seems odd why this policy would, particularly as it's obviously going to hurt everybody else in the world economy. So Iran's sort of calculating, it's going to hurt us, obviously, but it's going to hurt everybody else. Is that what the United States wants?
I mean, the obvious example that comes to mind under the regime that Iran has established for the Strait, we have a Chinese super tanker filled to the gills. And under the current regime, the new sheriff, as it were, that's $2 million a pop. Okay. Yeah. We said it, we verify it. Okay. And it's in Chinese UN. Okay. Okay, fine. So there you go. And then you're going to have an American destroyer or helicopter say, you need to stop.
Right.
And the what is a Chinese vessel going to do? Well, why? Right. What jurisdiction? What right. law has been broken? This right. has been bought and paid for. It's all under contract, and we're going home. Right. So what do you want from us?
Yes.
Okay. Or what's good, more likely that's going to happen is that there won't be any movement because, you know, do you want to be boarded? What happens if you're boarded? Are you going to be running a super tanker filled to the gills and you're like, and you're going to take the, you know, go ahead. No, I don't want to be held responsible for this. I mean, I'm just sailing the ship. You know, your cargo, you know, that's yours. I'm just trying to get it to port. And a lot of people say, well, we'll just have to wait and, you know, for the situation to change. It's because there'll be so much uncertainty. And George, add to it the possibility of violence. You know, like these crew, I didn't sign up for this. Okay. What? You know, you sign up on these things. I don't know what these super tankers, they have like a crew of 12. I mean, they're just very few people. And you're just, you know, you're making it maybe $1,000 a day. You're just counting your money. That's all you're doing is counting your money, getting it to port. Okay. Oh, we're going to have to wear a flak vest now. No, I didn't sign up for that. See, it creates too much uncertainty. Lloyd's of London will say, I don't know. You know, that, you know, it's the international insurance company's going to put a stop to all of this. And we're not going to insure you.
Okay. No.
The premium will be so high that then you get, there's a cost benefit analysis. Well, then all of that is passed on to the consumer.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think so. But I think it goes back, Len, to the question of what exactly is the United States trying to accomplish here. Now, from the comments, if you look carefully at the comments that the Iranians have made following the talks in Islamabad, they do seem to be suggest that some kind of an agreement could have been reached during the talk. So if you just look at what, let's say, Araghchi has said, you know, I mean, you know, they write very carefully. So just look at the way he has described. He says, in intensive talks at the highest levels in 47 years, Iran engaged with U.S. in good faith to end war. But when just inches away from Islamabad MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, we encountered maximalism, shifting goalposts, and blockade. Zero lessons earned, I guess it means learned. Goodwill begets goodwill. Enmity begets enmity. Now, that, you know, that suggests, at least what he's saying, is hey, as in Geneva, as in Oman, we seem to be close to an agreement. And then what happened?
Well,
go on.
Well, you know, one thing that did happen is that Netanyahu had his minders there. Kushner
right.
and Whitmer.
Right. Yeah. No, I think so. But that again raises the question: if you're that close to a deal, and then you walk away, and then you impose a blockade, very very dangerous and a reckless act.
It's an act of war.
Exactly, an act of war. And then Trump is again talking about renewing the bombing, which I don't think he's going to do, at least not at this stage. I mean, he could come back with that, but at this stage, I think he's realized didn't achieve very much, you know, doing the same
thing. That's a really good point. But who's driving this right now? Apparently, there was up to a dozen calls during those 21 hours that Vance or his team made back to the White House, presumably to Trump, maybe all or some of the time. It seems that they were told the Russian word "niet," okay, every step of the way. As far as the target bank, well, that's pretty much exhausted right now, unless they want to do the gasification, okay, where they want that we have to destroy the entire civilization, okay? I think Trump might, if he has any kind of reflection, he probably won't use that word again. Trying to destroy the Iranian state. And that means hospitals, that means schools, that means nursing homes, everything, like they did in Gaza. But that's a tall order.
I think that's a very tall order. And I do have my doubts that the United States can continue with that for any length of time. I mean, that you could start it for any length of time. I think that would just simply be, it would just be too embarrassing. I mean, and yeah. Trump is aware of, you know, these images coming through on the TV news shows. I mean, Israel can do this because Israel just basically, they don't care. The Israelis
just don't care.
But I think that's going to be difficult in the United States. I mean, I agree that could well be. But that's not really a strategy, and that's not going to get you what you want. It's not going to force a surrender. I mean, that's it should obviously be fairly apparent to Trump by now that Iran isn't going to surrender. I mean, if it didn't surrender after the assassination of, 35 or 50 members of its leadership, it isn't going to surrender.
Well, and George, it's on record. Everybody can go back and check. You and I agreed. If Trump can't get a resolution after 3 or 4 days, this is going to turn into a very long war.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think it's worth posing again. We talked about it briefly yesterday, because the Iranians are very kind of formalitic about documents and agreements and all that. They're really stickler. So people don't comprehend that. Okay, it's a very legalistic society, and you know, if it's written down, it's regular. That's what the rule is. Okay, I'm wondering at the end of this 2 week period that started a week ago. Tomorrow, okay, because Tuesday was the beginning of the ceasefire, are they going to let that go all the way and then reassess? I don't think they want to initiate anything.
No,
in this
that's what I was going to say. I think that if it comes to an end, if the ceasefire comes to an end, I don't think Iran will be the one that will end the ceasefire. So, you know, day 14 or day 15, does it come to an end? Well, not according to Iran. Iran would probably keep it going until the United States or Israel would then break the ceasefire. But I don't think they would be the ones to initiate the end of the ceasefire. But I do think that at this stage, where this is what day seven of the
day seven.
So there is time. I mean, there is time for another round. And again,
what do you think the likelihood of that is? I think it's essentially zero. What do you think?
I actually tend to think there will be another round. I don't think, I'm not sure it's going to be successful. In fact, I doubt that it'll be successful. But I tend to think that there will be another round. And that's, you know, just going by the tweet of Iran's ambassador to Pakistan. Who tweeted this out, the Islamabad talks is not an event but a process.
Yeah,
the Islamabad talks laid the foundation for a diplomatic process that, if trust and will are strengthened, can create a sustainable framework for the interests of all parties. I mean, it's a lot of you know, fancy words, but basically saying, hey, it's, you know, you can't expect to get an agreement on day one. And so, you know, there's still time for further.
You know, how do you interpret blockading the blockaders?
That's an escalation. That is an escalation. That's right. And then it says, I would like to express my gratitude and so on to the Pakistanis and so on. And then it says, the Iranian high-ranking negotiating team with dignity, self-confidence, and faith in Allah Almighty and attention to the concerns of the people pursued dignified talks for the great Iranian nation to ensure and secure the national interests and legitimate rights of the people. And now, here's the guy who was really the senior figure within the Iranian negotiating team in Islamabad. I mean, he was in charge. So he says, before the negotiations, I emphasize that we have the necessary good faith and will, but due to the experiences of two previous wars, we have no trust in the opposing side. Understandable. My colleagues on the Iranian delegation raised forward-looking initiatives, but the opposing sides ultimately failed to gain the trust of the Iranian delegation in this round of negotiations. So that's, you know, again, in formulation, they failed to gain our trust.
That's a very interesting formulation. You wouldn't think that, but that's that's nobility, George.
Yes, I agree. And then it says, America has understood our logic and principles, and now it's time for it to decide whether it can earn our trust or not. So again, you have to earn our trust. We consider
it's interesting, George, that he doesn't use like scumbag, okay. Bastards.
Yes, exactly. Deranged.
I mean, we have really kind of asymmetrical social media here.
Bastards.
Bastards.
We consider every mirror to be another method of authority diplomacy alongside military struggle for upholding the rights of the Iranian nation, and we will not for a moment cease our efforts to consolidate the achievements of the 40 days of Iran's national defense. And then I'm also grateful to, you know, a friendly and brotherly country, Pakistan. And then Iran is a body of 90 million souls from all heroic people of Iran who, following the advice of a supreme leader and by taking to the streets, supported their children and sent us on our way, and so on. So again, it goes back, hey, you have to win our trust if you want this to continue. So they're not ruling it out. Now, I mean, not ruling out any further talks. The problem with to go back to any kind of fighting is, well, you have no real prospects of this way of doing it, this way of doing it, of achieving any of your goals. So if you want to, you really want to win this, you want to force a surrender, if that's the goal, to force a surrender of Iran, then you're really going to have to escalate. And that, it's serious.
Yeah, but see, legal, rational thinkers in Washington should be thinking in the following way. They've failed to achieve victory. Why don't you work towards avoiding defeat?
Right. Right. Well, yeah.
You see what I'm trying to say?
Oh, I understand. Yeah.
And, you know, it's to create the conditions in which the United States and Israel, it's just the fanatical countries. It's so different. But, we're not going to drive the point that you were defeated. We're not going to drive the point that we are victors. We're going to let you, get off the hook and that you can avoid the perception of being defeated. And that's why diplomacy is really key right here.
But I still don't think that defeat would exactly... I mean, you failed to win. You haven't really been defeated. I mean, it's more the question of you're going to have a forever war. I mean, that the alternative...
Or you can have a forever war. Yeah, like, you're right. Yeah.
Iraq in the 1990s, which just simply go on pointlessly just bombing... doing some blockading, do some more bombing, more blockading.
Iraq couldn't fight back.
Iraq couldn't fight back. No, that's right. So in this case, yes, you would fight back. But also, okay, I mean, United States could probably live with their fighting back. I mean, I they could probably get away. They could probably get around Iran's fighting back so that it doesn't inflict too heavy a casualties. So I think they could just continue as.
Yeah, but see, George, again, thinking legal, rationally, the good Weberians that we are. You know, it's very similar to with Ukraine, in my mind, is that a way to avoid defeat is say, look, let's get the whole region together. All of this affects everybody in the region. We got to all sit down here, okay? And that's exactly what Iran wants. It wants to be back in the club,
right?
Okay? It wants its status recognized. It's a regional great power, okay? Right. I mean, and we looked at that article. I think you and Mark and I looked at that article about Iran is the new great superpower. Well, right. That may be a separate conversation. But that's one of the ways out, George.
No, it is one of the ways.
Why? Because, you know, call me naive or a fool, is that maybe the best way is to try to look for a win-win.
Well, I agree with that. I just don't think it's going to happen. I mean,
I'll have a glass of wine and I'll have another great idea for you. Okay,
exactly. One other topic I wanted to bring up was the extraordinary attack that Trump launched
on the pontiff. The
pontiff, exactly, which was kind of interesting. I mean, he hasn't liked the popes. He didn't like his predecessor, Pope Francis. He clearly doesn't like Pope Leo any better. However, normally what presidents do, you know, they don't like popes. They don't, there's a sort of separation of church and state, you know. Okay, you don't get quite into such a visceral attack.
But the issue, particularly, I suppose it applies to a lot of places, but in the American case, there's always that kind of lingering dual loyalty.
Yeah, that's right.
And but I think American Catholics over the last half century have very much gone their own way on many different levels. But I'm just speechless. Attacking the Pope.
No, that's right. It's like, and this is what's always interesting about Trump is. You always wonder, well, why are you doing this? I mean, you don't have to do this. I mean, he's the Pope. He's got different agendas. You may not like his agenda, but he's got a different agenda. And popes are never particularly, they don't really support wars. They don't really support killings. They don't really support sanctions. You know, all these kinds of things that, you do, that you're not going to get the chief religious leader, one of the leaders of the Christian world. You're not going to get him to support your war. I mean, that's not part of his brief. He's not part of his remit to support a war. So it's kind of a strange to launch this tirade against the Pope because he's not endorsing your actions. Anyway, let's quickly take a look.
Again, it's one of these seismic changes over the last 3 years with the advent of what's happened to Gaza is that, of course, you're going to have the evangelicals, Christian Zionists, by their very definition, are very supportive of Israel. Catholics are not, okay?
No.
And that's just not their thing. And it's remarkable in its absurdity that Christian Zionists don't give a hoot about Christians in the Middle East. They just don't. Catholics do.
Yep.
Okay. And they do care about their brethren. I mean, these are the original Christians. Okay. These are the original churches. These are the original communities. Yep. And they feel the bishops feel compelled. To speak out, and they their congregations want to know about this. It's so amazing how Christian Zionists have been able to shut down that, but the Catholics don't. And this is not a good time, Donald Trump, to go after the Pope. Okay,
right.
Because white people that voted for Donald Trump are predominantly Catholic.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. No, I don't know whether they would necessarily particularly go against Trump on this issue. I mean,
you're right. You're taking. I took that too far. What I'm just saying, this is not a good look. This is kind of an extra layer of irritants that you're creating for yourself.
I agree. Anyway, here he is. He's saying Pope Leo is weak on crime and terrible for foreign policy. So again, you know, weak on crime. I mean, he's not. You're not going to get him.
He's not up to become Pope Leo isn't up to isn't being nominated to be attorney general. Okay,
that's right. He's not a policymaker, and terrible for foreign policy. And he doesn't run foreign policy. He talks about fear of the Trump administration, but doesn't mention the fear that the Catholic Church and all of the Christian organization had during COVID, when they were arresting priests, ministers, and everybody else for holding church services, even when going outside and being 10 or 20 feet apart. Well, this happened during Trump's term as well. I mean, it's not like during the Trump years, during his first years, there wasn't exactly this kind of absolutely outrageous, brutal behavior towards churches. I mean, there was just a crackdown on all social gatherings, but that happened under Trump. It happened under Biden. I mean, it was outrageous. So it's hard to say why somehow you're bringing this up now. I mean, it doesn't seem to have any relevance to anything. And then he says, I like his brother Lewis much better than I like him, because Lewis is all MAGA. He gets it and Leo doesn't. I don't want a pope who thinks it's okay for Iran to have a nuclear weapon. Not sure the pope Iran it's okay for Iran to have a nuclear weapon, but okay. I don't want a pope who thinks it's terrible that America attacked Venezuela, a country that was sending massive amounts of drugs into the United States, and even worse, emptying their prisons, including murderers, drug addicts, drug dealers, and killers into our country.
Mr. Trump,
you can't expect the Pope to think it's a great idea to attack Venezuela. You're not going to get him to endorse an attack on Venezuela.
Yeah, but I thought it wasn't an attack on Venezuela. I thought it was just a police action.
Yes. And I don't want a pope who criticized the president of the United States because I'm doing exactly what I was elected in a landslide to do, setting record low numbers in crime, creating the greatest stock market in history. Leo should be thankful because, as everyone knows, he was a shocking surprise. He wasn't on any list to be pope and was only put there by the church because he was an American and they thought he would be the best way to deal with President Trump. If I wasn't in the White House, Leo wouldn't be in the Vatican. Leo's weak on crime. Back he goes. Leo's weak on crime, weak on nuclear weapons. Does not sit well with me, nor does the fact that he meets with Obama sympathizers like David Axelrod, a loser from the left, who is one of those who wanted churchgoers and clerics to be arrested. Leo should get his act together as Pope, use common sense, stop catering to the radical left, and focus on being a great pope, not a politician. It's hurting him very badly. And more importantly, it's hurting the Catholic Church. All right. We don't need to go
into... Where to begin?
We don't need to go into great details. It's a very strange thing for Trump to be... He kind of preoccupies himself with all sorts of things. You got a lot of problems on your plate. And you're picking a fight with the Pope. In between time, you know, you're commenting on the U.S. Masters, you know, the golf tournament.
Yeah, well, I mean, when the negotiations were going on in Islamabad, Trump and Marco Rubio were at a UFC.
Yeah, an ultimate fight, yeah, UFC, yeah, yeah. Yes. Trump picking a fight with the Pope.
Anyway, well, who else is left?
Well, I used to have, you know, Robert De Niro, but he's kind of seems to have lost interest in Robert De Niro. I mean, I guess.
Maybe that's one of the few things I have in common with Donald Trump. I lost interest with De Niro too.
Me too.
Heartbreaking for me because he's one of the great actors as I was growing up, and now he's just a complete embarrassment. He's an imbecile.
Yeah, I agree.
And then what was the last film? Can somebody in the chat tell me what was that last big film he made? Was The Irishman, was it called?
Well, he made The Irishman. It was already a few years back. I don't know if that's his last.
Yeah, that was a really awful film. Yeah. It was truly awful. Here's a guy. You know, wait, do you do it for money? I mean, aren't you already a gazillionaire?
Yeah, I tend to think is that people like that, they don't really have anything much in their lives. So it's not like, so if they're not making movies, however abysmal and however little it does for your reputation, they just can't help themselves because they've got nothing else to do. So you would think, well, you know, you've got some solid work behind you. Why do you want to trash your reputation by making crap? But I think, you know, the people, they just can't stop themselves. You know, it's like they have to make 1, 2, 3 films a year, you know, when they don't really need to. They don't need the money or anything else. They don't know what else to do with themselves. Let's go to our Gaggle Locals page and look at our gagglers and some of their comments. So Stone River, thank you very much, Stone River, says, "Is it only me? The transmission keeps freezing." I don't know. I mean, I don't know if that's you.
Okay, this is the odd world of live streaming. George's focus goes in and out a little bit, but maybe it's me doing that. See, whatever you think is happening to the other guy is happening to you. That's been my experience.
I think so, but I haven't noticed you freezing, Peter, today. I mean, there have been times in the past, but today I haven't noticed you freezing.
It's like my new VPN.
Anyway, a good friend, Cynthia, thank you very much for your generosity. Cynthia says, "I'd argue that Viktor Orban's alignment with Benjamin Netanyahu and the Trump Vance ticket may well have hurt him electorally. Orban openly rejected the ruling of the ICC, which found Netanyahu responsible for war crimes, and went further, stating that Hungary would not enforce an arrest if Netanyahu visited. He even extended an invitation, doubling down on his position, and in the eyes of his critics, tarnishing Hungary's international standing." Well, I understand your point, Cynthia. I don't think this had much impact on the election. I don't think Hungarians care that much about the Middle East. It's just not really on their horizon. And Hungary has become, you know, for a variety of reasons in recent decades, not wholly due to Orban, it's become a very philo-Semitic place. It's one where you really don't say anything negative about Jews, and by implication, you don't really say anything very much negative about Israel. There really isn't any strong anti-Israel sentiment in Hungary. So when Orban did that, the outrage came internationally. There wasn't really much outrage in Hungary. It was neither particularly popular nor particularly unpopular. I just don't think Hungarians really cared one way or the other about the Middle East and Netanyahu. So the people who were unhappy about it, they didn't count for anything in Hungary.
Yeah, well, like George and I have pointed out, most of the commentary about Hungary over the last week or so are by non-Hungarians.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I don't think much of the ICC, and I kind of like it. Leave aside Netanyahu. I mean, I don't think much of the ICC, and I don't think Hungarians are craving to be back in the ICC, though I'm sure Magyar will lead Hungary back into the ICC. And then here, well, let's just first we'll go to the people who have got the money. And then Dan Rock, thank you very much, Dan Rock, for your generosity. Vic Shakopoulos. He says, "I think it's relevant, so I'm coming back to the Polish-Hungarian question." So Vic has been raising this Polish-Hungarian question with me. I don't know now. This has to be about the third live stream that he's bringing. Okay, "I think it's relevant, so I'm coming back to the Polish-Hungarian question. The interests of the two states indeed differed in the interwar period. Yet Poland, who was favored by the Versailles system, played a key part in dismantling it and partitioning Czechoslovakia together with the revisionist Hungarians and Germans." Okay. On the other hand, in the 21st century, in my opinion, the interests of both nations do align. The 1991 status quo and peace between East and West benefited both states, but the time, as you correctly stated, Warsaw's policy differs from Budapest and Poland's, yet again as acting as a revisionist power against its own interests. So sometimes the interests of both states don't align, but their policies do, 1930s and now their intentions, interests do, but their policies don't. Anyway, if the Poles had for once conducted a logical and not suicidal foreign policy, a Warsaw-Budapest neutral axis, which could be joined, for example, by Czechia, Slovakia, and Austria, could end this idiotic European conflict and act as a status quo power in the region, just as the Habsburg Empire used to. Now, I mean, I think that it's all very reasonable, but I think that this was the plan, I think, when Orban kind of created this Visegrad grouping, which involved Poland, Hungary, the Czech Republic, and Slovakia. It was a sort of, well, we have this Central European grouping of nations. Well, it kind of broke apart because Poland is more interested in, you know, persisting with this war against Russia and pushing NATO into a war against Russia. That seems to be Poland's interest. Well, you're not going to get Hungary and Slovakia getting on board with that. And so that's why this Visegrad grouping became, after a while, kind of meaningless, because on fundamental goals, they were not in alignment.
And particularly since in the case of Poland, their primary interest now is to elevate itself in the pecking order within the EU and NATO. Okay, that's their goals right there. I mean, when I can tell you when France and Germany or in Italy, the E3, that E3, the Poles just they their teeth grind. Why aren't we in that club?
That's right. That's right.
You know. They look. I lived in Eastern Europe for 10 years. And this kind of, you know, Polish, Hungarian, Czech, you know, Slovak. It's an interesting idea, but they don't like each other very much.
Right.
Okay? They just don't.
Right.
And in Eastern Europe, nobody likes anybody else. Okay?
No, I think that's...
It doesn't mean hatred or, you know, it's not political. You know, it's just like, you know, we don't mix.
Right. No, I think, and that's what...
It was my experience.
That's what really started this whole correspondence, or what you will, with Vic, which is I said that this is a myth about the great historic friendship between Poland and Hungary. And I said, well, it's more a myth.
You know why, Vic? I'll tell you why. Because they never bordered each other.
They never did. But they weren't... There's no real friendship. I mean, there have been times when Poland and Hungary... were on the same side, but there have also been times when they weren't on the same side. So there really isn't a kind of a historic friendship, as if somehow these are the brotherhood of nations. It's something that's trotted out at various times. The Poles, in particular, are now doing this. Well, they were doing this during Orban in order to somehow berate Orban. Well, you are betraying the long tradition of Polish-Hungarian friendship. But he wasn't betraying. He said, well, we have our own interests. You have your interests. And I'm afraid our interests simply do not align. So just simply talking about some historic friendship, well, that's not going to cut it.
Okay, well, here we go. This is one of Peter's periodic good points. Well, I appreciate that feedback.
Good points? What good points?
Well, I don't know. apparently, it's not very often.
Anyway, Cynthia then comes back and says that Iran should see Israel, not the Gulf states, as the main target. If the aim is to add pressure to speed an end to the war, then focusing on Israel would be more effective. Forcing Israelis to stay in shelters all day and night and badly damaging key infrastructure could raise pressure on the U.S. to push for a deal. By contrast, hitting the Gulf states does little to move that goal and is not likely to speed up at the end of the conflict. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think very broadly speaking, and this is something George and I talked about yesterday, is that Iran wants out of the cage, okay? And it wants a paradigm shift for the entire region. And some of the major thorns that they want to address, and that's I think it's 13 military bases, American military bases, in and around the Persian Gulf. They want them gone, okay? If we look at what has been destroyed, and I mean, this is very economical in terms of information, those bases have been made inoperable, so they've achieved that. If it was against the Gulf states, the Gulf states could be taken out in a night, just their desalinization. Then it's over. It's just over. Pack and leave. They haven't done that, okay? And that's one of the things I stressed with George, I think, in one of our live streams last week. Why Islamabad? And one of my theories is that the Iranians know they need to mend some fences with the Arab world in a pretty big way. But I see your point here. A lot of very important things that it wants to achieve. It wants to have its control over the Hormuz. They want to get American military bases out. They want to punish Israel for what they've been doing to them for decades. But they want a paradigm shift. They want Iran to be recognized as a legitimate great power in the region. Okay, and that's why this is going to be a long war, because as George and I have tried to say over and over again, the Americans want a deal. The Russians want a strategic shift. Iran wants a strategic shift. That's why any deal over 21 hours is just fantasy.
Yeah, well, I think that's right. And as Dan Rock says, hi, George. I think even the most pessimistic didn't expect such an Orban catastrophic fall. I agree. I still believe Trump and Vance endorsements hurt a little bit. Perhaps enough to give Magyar majority. Well, that's interesting. I tend to think that it probably didn't help very much. I don't think it hurt so much. And I think Trump, as I said earlier, I think had Trump made money available earlier on, it could have made a difference. J.D. Vance really, I don't think he made much of an impact when he arrived in Hungary, because, and I really think it's oddly enough, we follow U.S. politics closely, so we know, we have a good awareness of J.D. Vance. In other countries, they really don't know who the vice president of the United States is. So when J.D. Vance arrives in Hungary, Hungarians don't really know who J.D. Vance is. I was the vice president, but he's not on the radar because they just don't know who the vice president. I remember back in the 80s when George H.W. Bush, who was Reagan's vice president, he came to London to deliver a major speech on nuclear weapons, because that was at the time of the nuclear hysteria. And I think most people had no idea who George Bush was. Oh, he's the vice president of the United States. Well, that's very important. But they just didn't know who he was. People knew very well who Reagan was, but they didn't know who Bush was. And I think some of that was a problem for Orban. You had the big buildup, the big, the vice president is here. And then J.D. Vance, and the people look at him. Who is this person, this youngish-looking guy with an Indian wife and with a beard and everything? So I just don't think it made any real difference. I just don't think it hurt him. Hungary is oddly enough kind of a little closed off from the world. We think a lot about the Middle East and so on. I don't think Hungarians spend a great deal of time thinking about Iran, the Persian Gulf, and other than how it impacts Hungary. Is it going to bring a lot of migrants into the country? Yeah, that's a problem. But all the rest, the rights and wrongs of this war, I don't think that Hungarians are that preoccupied with that. That's that's my take. Peter, any lasting thoughts as we
I mean, one of the good things about doing a live stream is that, you know, once we finish, because we do it in real time, we're working with real time news. When we do our Zoom recordings, we always regret it 20 minutes later.
Well, that's right. Because
something had happened while we were talking or right
exactly.
afterwards. I mean, the point I'm trying to make is that keeping up with all of this is, it's work. It's really work. Like for my the program I'm going to record tomorrow, I'm just going to wait until mid-morning tomorrow even to think about it, because what's the point?
You're right. I mean, because on the East Coast of the United States, it's still morning. So there's a lot of time between now and close of business on Monday.
There.
Yeah, close of business on Monday. And knowing Trump tweet truths out long after business hours. You know, it could be kind of in the early morning hours on the East Coast. So we just don't know what else is going to happen. So you've got to you have to play it by ear. It's very hard to keep up. And of course, that's what your dogs always say. We're having real difficulties. You know, we can't even get a good night's sleep. So if you have any money lying around, please tip jar. Anyway, so thank you very much for joining us today. We will be back. There he is. You know, the man himself. So we'll be back. Same time. We've seemed to have solved our problems. And we'll be back.
He's falling asleep.
Well, he's got insomnia. He's trying to sleep it off. So we'll be back next Monday at 10 a.m. for our joint live stream. And please join me tomorrow for my solo 3 p.m. Eastern time. Until then, all the best. See you.